two very wonderful, wonderful people this morning. Thank you. Salt Lake City, Utah, may have seemed like an unlikely locale for a gathering of several thousand Unitarian Universalists this past summer. But there we were, back last June, holding our 48th General Assembly. The hotel where I stayed, as a matter of fact, was right across the street from Tabernacle Square, the home base of the Mormon Church. I walk past it every day on my way to join my fellow Unitarian Universalists, even took a brief tour at one point. I have to say, the good people of Salt Lake City could not have been more accommodating for us, and I enjoyed myself for the several days that I was there. I enjoyed myself, even though the candidate I and several members of our congregation here supported for the presidency of the UUA did not get elected. I was our district coordinator for the candidacy of Reverend Laurel Hallman, the now retired minister of the First Unitarian Church of Dallas, Texas. I am sure that our association will benefit from Laurel's wisdom and abilities in the future, even though she will not be serving as our president. A marriage has brought Laurel now to the Boston area. I hope at some point in the future that I can invite her to our pulpit here. Our association's new president is the Reverend Peter Morales. Until this past June, he was the minister of one of the larger and more rapidly growing churches in our UU family, the Unitarian Universalist Church of Golden, Colorado. Like Reverend Hallman, Peter is a very dynamic, energetic individual with a deep commitment to our liberal religious movement. So now our United States Supreme Court has its first Latina justice. We Unitarian Universalists have our first Latino president. So I welcome people, Peter's leadership. I offer him my support in whatever ways I am able to give it. Peter's campaign theme was called A Religion for Our Time, and he built his campaign around the moves and the initiatives that he felt our association, as it is made up of member congregations like this one here, need to be taking in order for us to be a religion for our time. Well, I'm not going to revisit Peter's campaign platform this morning, but I'm going to do my bit for the challenge he has put forth by taking up that topic as we begin another year in our church life here together. Unbelievable as it is for me to think about it, my 22nd one as the minister of this congregation. What must we do? How must we act? What do we need to affirm and promote? If we here at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Nashua are to be a religion for our time in this community, in our larger world, as well as just right here amongst ourselves, and then within the deepest parts of our personal lives as well. Well, I'll plunge right in, say brokers. A religion for our time is one that assumes religious pluralism. A few weeks ago, I was flipping through my latest issue of Newsweek, and I come across an article titled, We're All Hindus Now. The title was enough for me to stop flipping pages and start reading. We're all Hindus now, what is this? So, well, conceding, as the authors concede that avowed Hindus make up only a very small fraction of our nation's population, but the author's larger point was that the Hindu precept that there are many gods and goddesses, all of which are representations of the same divine reality, is actually coming to be embraced by a majority of Americans in one sense or another. Now, we may not, and in fact, we largely do not, put it the same way I just did, with talk of gods and goddesses and divine reality in the manner that practicing Hindus do. Most of us, that is to say, do not speak the language of Hinduism. A Pew survey, however, according to 2008 Pew Research Project, indicates that on a deeper level, though, we're thinking like Hindus. The survey revealed that 65% of us believe that many religions can lead to eternal life, including, interestingly enough, 37% of white evangelicals. The author goes on to quote a Dr. Stephen Prothero, who is a professor of religion at Boston University. Dr. Prothero notes that what he calls the American propensity, I like this term, divine deli cafeteria religion, he says that is very much in the spirit of Hinduism. He went on to say this: you're not picking and choosing from different religions because we're all the same. They're all the same. It's not about orthodoxy. It's about what works. If going to yoga works, great. And if going to Catholic Mass works, great. And if going to Catholic Mass plus yoga plus the Buddhist retreat works, that's great too. He kind of says we're kind of putting a lot of things together. I think we're a religion, we have a faith tradition that is particularly positioned and suited for this kind of approach. So I did. I read the whole article. I got the point. But I also knew it was not the whole point. A religion for our time doesn't just assume pluralism. I think we kind of got that piece of it down pretty well, actually. It also must offer a place to park your car. And I guess I'm going to tell you a story. Let me tell you the story where I got that line. During the last week in July, in addition to my trip to Salt Lake, I made a couple of westward trips this summer. In addition to my trip to Salt Lake, I also took a 5-day, 20-hour seminar from one of my spirit guides, theologians, and teachers of the past 40 years, Dr. Sam Keen. So I've known Sam Keen from his writings over the course of 4 decades. This was the first time I'd actually got a chance to meet him in person. When I saw that he was offering a course there at Pacific School of Religion, and realizing that I'd read his first book in 1969, my first thought was, my God, he's still alive. And I better get out there and catch this while I can. So off I went. He is alive, well, writing, still offering workshops and seminars at the age of 77. That is when he is not tending a farm he has out in Sonoma, California, out near the wine country. Well, I got 2 Sam Keen stories for you this morning. This is the first one. Among the many participants in his seminar was a semi-retired priest. He was a delightful, humorous, and very bright man. Due to a pronounced lifelong hearing deficiency, he wore a very large hearing aid, and he spoke in a very clear, but rather slowly drawn-out kind of way. At one point in the week, our discussions got around the topic of personal beliefs and spiritual practices and the way we keep ourselves grounded and such as that. This priest offered that part of his ritual every morning as he prepared for the day was to recite the Nicene Creed. Those of you who are Catholic know what that's about. I believe in God the Father, Almighty, Maker of heaven and earth, etc. But without being confrontational or judgmental about it, Sam pushed him a little bit on that. He asked the good father if he did this because he actually believed the words of the Nicene Creed, or because he valued and needed the experience of saying the same words every day, whatever they happen to be. Well, rather than respond directly to the question that was put to him, the priest replied, "I do it because I need a place to park my car." Just like that. And the fact that he had to speak that way, in that cadence kind of manner, made his statement really all the more striking. Well, there were a wide range, very wide range, of religious persuasions represented in that room, and I would say that all of us, even the one and only and yours truly Unitarian Universalist, we kind of got it. He wasn't saying we should all embrace the Nicene Creed. He was simply saying, I need a place to stand. I need a place from which I can engage with the world. A world of people and events and nature and mystery and wonder, and do it in some meaningful way. And his shorthand for all that was a place to park my car. A place from which I can get up and get out, be about the things I need to do, and then come back to my car again, knowing it'll be there waiting for me in the same place where I left it. So if we are to be a religion for our time, we must not only affirm religious pluralism. Like I said, we got that part down pretty well. We also have to offer a place where we can each and all, long newcomer and long timer alike, can park our cars. I'll throw in here, if you don't like a metaphor, that uses an internal combustion fossil fuel consuming pollution spewing device, you are free, of course, to pick another one. You know, talk about, where's John Burbitt here? Talk about parking your bicycle. You know, that's, you do that instead. Same idea. All right. I'm going to return to this point in a little more developed way next Sunday when I speak to the topic of belief for non-believers. That's the title of another writing project I took up this summer. But I'll round out with this personal note for today. I parked my car in a space that affirms the matter of Albert Schweitzer, whom we heard from earlier, that affirms a reverence for life. I parked my car in a space that believes life contains within it a sacred and holy dimension. I parked my car in a space that believes I can touch that sacred or divine peace within myself and have my life deepened and enhanced for doing it. Personally, I find I don't need a supreme being in my parking space in order for it to contain all that it does, all that I just said. But I have a feeling that my parking space and that of my priest friend of last summer share at least some of the same characteristics. Not all, to be sure. There's no Nicene Creed or any other Orthodox creed or dogma in my parking place. But I stand ready to walk with any and all people, whatever religious label they may use for themselves, who seek to promote a greater degree of reverence and care and compassion for this sacred and fragile world and its inhabitants in which we all live. Well, moving on. A religion for our time is one that both affirms the sacredness of our individual lives while also calling us to a vision and to an awareness that reaches far beyond our individuality. This is actually true. This is actually the case of religions for all times and all places, not just ours. But I'd say it's an understanding that is ever more crucial for the time and the place that we're in right now. To get at that, I'm going to back up a little bit from the time and place we're in. Go back to 1835. And the French sociologist and historian Alexis de Tocqueville made his very insightful journey through here, through this part of the country and south of here, through the new land, it was still the new land of America, and he wrote about it in a book he titled Democracy in America. And in one chapter of his book, he offers up religion. In this case, he's talking about it in the form of Christianity, because that was the religion he was mostly exposed to then. He offers up religion as the antidote or the corrective to self-interest. He noted that capitalism, as it was taking shape in this country then, needed to be based on an ethic of self-interest if it was going to work. He further noted that a doctrine of pure capitalism had very little need for any kind of a concept of the common good. Its workings primarily rely upon individuals or groups of individuals gaining what they can on the basis of their individual effort. Now, Tocqueville, he did not decry that. He didn't put it down. He was not a socialist. Perhaps I should say he was not a socialist either. But he held that religion at its best. You've seen what religion can do at its worst. He was saying that religion at its best needed to be an element in the overall societal mix that offered a counterforce to that of self-interest. He saw religion as offering an ethic that called people to a higher common interest. And here's how he put it, very parochial and male-dominated language, but we're talking 1835 here. Christianity teaches that men ought to benefit their fellow creatures for the love of God. They freely sacrifice their personal interests to the consummate order of all created things and expect no other recompense than the pleasure of contemplating it. When you cut through all that parochial language, what he's saying is that religion, again at its best, offers a counterbalance to individual self-interest, a counterpoint that calls for the sacrificing at times of personal interest to what Tocqueville called the consummate order of all created things. And we do that sacrificing solely for the pleasure of contemplating that greater order, that greater well-being of all created things. archaic as this language may be, I thought about these words in the light of some of these healthcare forums that took place back last August. Yeah, maybe you do too. The most disturbing and frightening aspect of these events, I felt, were the orchestrated attempts, some of which were successful at what can only be called mob rule. But in addition to such orchestrated disruptions, along with the promulgation of blatant falsehoods by many who know better, was a seeming absence of any sense that we as a society share a common stake in the good health of all our citizens. I had to wonder if the Tocqueville had just offered up the same sentiments as I just cited at one of these gatherings, probably with a little bit of updated language, he probably would have been shouted down too. Yes, I want the assurance that my health care plan will continue to give me the care that I need, particularly as I move into what I'm sort of gingerly calling the latter stages of my life. But thanks in large part to the religious values and principles I have come to hold, I also recognize that I do not stand apart from, I do not pursue my own well-being apart from the Tocqueville's consummate order of all created things. I also have a stake in that greater order of things. My health and my well-being and the health and well-being of all of us is bound up in a larger common good. And certainly, of course, to be sure, competing strategies and methods of bringing us close as we can get to the goal of universal health care, they do need to be brought forth, and they need to be debated, and they need to be wrestled over, and some compromises attained now and then, but it must be done in the spirit that we're all in this together. And that in time, as John Donne reminded us, the bell tolls for all of us. A religion for our time, one that keeps such a spirit and such a vision of a common humanity ever before us, whatever the issue may be. Before I leave this point, I want to share a portion of a letter that came out about a month ago, still timely, from our new association's new president, Peter Morales, to his fellow Unitarian Universalists on the whole healthcare debate. I'm just going to read a part of it. The current hysteria and rancor over healthcare policy are profoundly disturbing. Religious principles central to our shared duty of faith are involved. The first such principle is compassion. We must be a strong, persistent voice that reminds our religious leaders that compassion is central to all major faith traditions. We must insist that healthcare reform protects those without political clout, children, the poor, the disabled, the elderly. To stand on the side of love is to stand with those on the margins. The central principle of our faith is that we affirm our commitment to the democratic process. We are witnessing cynical demagoguery that plays on fear to defend privilege. There is no place for intimidation in our public discussion. Demagogues foment fear and panic that leads to violence. As religious people, we must oppose intimidation. Good people can and do disagree about healthcare policy. However, we must demand open, respectful debate. As religious people, we must insist on two things. We must create a healthcare system that protects the most vulnerable, and we must insist upon a democratic process that is open to all. Faithfully, Peter Morales. I welcome Peter's presidency. I value his voice in the public arena. Since he wrote that letter, at least in some quarters, some saner voices have come to be heard on this issue. Even as the ugliness and the crudeness was on display at some of the healthcare forums, has worked its way right into the halls of Congress during a presidential address, no less. Given all of this, I am still holding out hope for a rational and compassionate way of bringing an adequate level of healthcare to all of our citizens as a matter of right and not privilege. Final point for the day. A religion for our time is one that seeks not to transport us to some other world once we're done with this one, one that calls us instead to the fullest measure of life and living that we can attain in the time that is given us right here. This gets me to my second and my final Sam Key story. The first book of his that I read, the one I referred to clear back in 1969, which was the year it was published, is called to a dancing god. Still got it on my shelf. It's kind of starting to fall apart, but I've still got it. It's a story in the first book I read, To a Dancing God. It has a very 1960s kind of a flavor to it, but it's still got some transcendent and rather timeless parts as well, especially a chapter which he has about what he calls a peach seed monkey. In that chapter, Sam tells a story about his father, whom he adored, about his life growing up with him in a rural part of Tennessee in the 1930s and 40s. Dr. Keene and I share a common origin in that we were both raised in the evangelical climate and ethos of the rural South. In the story, as related to A Dancing God, Sam Keene tells of sitting with his father as a young boy and watching him carve a little monkey out of a peach seed. He's completely fascinated by such an act of creation, and he asks his father if the little monkey is for him. His father says, "No, I'm carving this one for my wife, Sam's mother, but I will make another one for you." Time goes by. Much of a life goes by. For one reason or another, the second peach seed monkey never gets carved. The day eventually arrives when the adult doctor, Sam Keene, is visiting his now elderly father in a care facility in Arizona, listening to his father and talking with his father as he takes the measure of his life as his life comes to a close. At one point in the conversation, the father tells the son that he hopes he's done well by him, hopes he didn't let him down anywhere along the way, and the son hastens to assure the father, "No, Dad, you never let me down." And then as a kind of afterthought, with a slight touch of humor, he adds, "Well, you never did make me that peach seed monkey." Dr. Keene goes back to his life as a writer and philosopher and academician. A couple weeks later, he gets a small package in the mail. It contains a peach seed carved in the shape of a monkey. The note with it says that one of the legs broke off while it was being carved and had to be glued back on because, quote, "I don't have time to carve another one." Yeah. And then the next line in Dr. Keene's story goes, 2 weeks later, my father died. He died only at the end of his life. The story, of course, is about living and dying with a sense of completion and fulfillment, knowing you did the things you needed to do. And we also know that we're not always going to get it right all the time. And some things will inevitably be left incomplete. Sometimes the best you can do is glue the leg back on, hope that's good enough, and keep going. But the ideal is one clearly we're striving after, to die only at the end of one's life. I read that story, as I said, about 40 years ago, and it's remained a part of my personal scripture and one of my guideposts for living ever since. Okay, now, cut to about 2 months ago. I'm sitting in the aforementioned classroom at Pacific School of Religion, taking in the wisdom of one of my longtime teachers. We didn't use To a Dancing God as one of our texts. Dr. Keene had other places he wanted to go, which was fine. But somewhere in the course of an open class discussion, things somehow led around Sam Keene telling this very story, peach seed monkey. There were a few people in that room who I doubt were even close to being born when he wrote the book that contains the story, and I didn't know sitting there if anybody else in the room had even read it other than myself. But there was something mesmerizing for me about sitting just a few feet away from the creator of a story that has stayed with me for the good part of my life and hearing it from the creator's mouth. And then when Dr. Keene got to the end, when he got to the part about getting the package in the mail with the carved monkey with the glued leg on, his voice caught in his throat. And he had to pause for a second or two before he could go on. All these years later, it was still with him, right there. We took a class break a few minutes later, and I walked up the desk where he was sitting. About a week or so earlier, before I got out there, I had gone with my wife, Michelle, son, Gordon, and Crystal. We had been to a Billy Joel Elton John concert. And so I said to Sam Keene, I said, "You know, it's one thing to know all the words to Piano Man. It's another thing altogether to watch and listen to Billy Joel sing it. I've been reading your peach seed monkey story off and on for the last 40 years, but it's nothing like sitting and listening to you tell it. Thank you for that." He very graciously thanked me for my words, and that was the end of our conversation. A religion for our time is one that offers a path for living so that we die only at the end of our lives. It offers a place to park your car, a personal and sacred space of your own, from which you then engage with the world around. And it offers a vision that calls you beyond the bounds of the self into the greater life of the human family, and beyond that, into the even greater life of our earth and universe. We now take up, once again, the joyful and demanding and ever so crucial task of being that kind of religion and building that kind of religious community as we embark upon another church year. So let's get on with it. Let's sing together number 354, Laugh and Cry.